Oh my god, you saw a manananggal.
This is a Gods Must Be Crazy first, a perfect score in a quiz. They have no words for weapons, hostility, or war. They don't even realize that there was a country. They didn't realize that there was a sea. We got deeply philosophical at the end of this hoax.
Gods Must Be Crazy podcast.
I'm Anima.
And I'm Ice. And we're your hosts. The Gods Must Be Crazy is a podcast on Philippine mythology and folklore.
Yes. Well, anyways, we're recording in a new place. It's actually the first place we recorded.
Yes, our first ever episode was recorded
Brian's studio. And so, you know, it's always good to go to new liminal spaces. And try to find out, you know, new feelings and new ways of doing things. So, in the spirit of new ways and new spirit of doing things.
Oh, that was a segue.
I know, I didn't realize that. It's a segue. My story today is a newer story.
A newer story. Okay.
And if you recall, during our previous episode on Mayari, we talked about reinterpretation, misinterpretations. And is the spirit of true mythology the fact that it is written down? Is the spirit of true mythology a pure origin?
Mm-hmm.
And what it really is in terms of like, isn't mythology and folklore a living, continuing thing, right?
Okay.
And so myth-making is not something that stops.
Yeah.
Myth-making is something that continues.
And there For sure.
And there was an era in our history, in the Philippine history, where myths were actively being created.
Okay.
Or not, question mark.
Okay.
For a certain ends. And so I will be talking about the mythical and very real Tasadai people.
So they're real.
They're real.
They're not a hoax or... Because I heard about a hoax.
Yes. Well, or something. That was... Okay. That I came into this story with one expectation of anger. And I came away with like, huh, it's not as black and white. As with many of our stories, it's not as black and white as we think. So we'll start off with a quiz.
Okay. I'm so excited.
So
back, is there a prize? Just kidding.
There's a prize.
Pride.
With pride and winning. And your Lolo will be proud of you. Ice read an article about the Tasadai years and years
when
ago.
When I was like, but a child.
Yeah, so there might be
There were no children's books back home. I was the first like grandchild.
No.
So I was just surrounded by like newspapers, National Geographic, which my Lolo was a subscriber of.
That's so rich.
Back when you could subscribe to National Geographic.
We did, Reader's Digest.
Oh, yeah. We also were subscribed to that.
But we weren't subscribed. I think we would buy it from the grocery or the gas station.
And the only thing I would read would be the jokes. You know, like...
At the end of every article, there's like a joke or anecdote.
Or like there's a page, just all the jokes.
Yes.
And then I would pretend to read National Geographic. But I do remember the cover, like that specific cover photo of the Tasadai, and like that there were some, you know, Stone Age, whatever.
Yes.
They just
Stone Age is the operative term
in the Philippines.
Yes. So okay, so
this is exciting.
It's very exciting, okay. And I think we'll learn a couple of new things. So unlike other stories that we've done, I tried to go as broad in terms of sources, and so in our show notes, there will be more sources than usual because I really wanted to get like different perspectives of what it is. And because it's a newer myth, quote unquote, then there were a lot more sources and differing perspectives.
Okay.
So quiz time.
Okay.
Where is the Tasadai tribe located? Multiple choice.
Okay.
A, Amazon rainforest.
I forgot this.
All B, Indonesian archipelago. All
right.
C, South Cotabato.
Okay.
D, Manado, a border island nearly adjacent to Sulu.
C,
South Cotabato. Correct.
Yes.
Correct. They are located near Lake Cebu. Not Cebu with a C, Cebu with an S.
Yeah. Cebu.
Yes. Which is the tribes, they're part of the Lumad, the Lumad group.
Yeah.
So the Luma group, though, are more known for like very sophisticated weaving, mm-hmm. very advanced and very specific heritage and culture.
Where is this map-wise for the reference? Of...
In South Cotabato, if the Philippines is a person, it's like sort of like kneeling down person because like no legs. It's in the bottom.
Yeah.
Almost absolute bottom, South Cotabato. Okay. It's almost of the main Mindanao.
So is it at like the lower end of the Mindanao Peninsula?
Yes, very much at the very lower end. Or southeast, west.
Okay.
Southwest.
Okay.
Yes. Okay, next question. Which of the following was a notable trait of the Tasadai when they were discovered in the 1970s? Discovered in quotes.
Okay.
A, they had a unique language.
All right.
B, they were adept at using smartphones. C, they were known for their bronze artworks. D, they lived in modern houses.
I mean, it's gotta be A.
Yes, unique language. And that'll come in later on.
Yeah. Because everything else was not like, you know, Stone Age.
Smartphones.
Ish.
Sure.
Yeah, sure.
Depending on how old the iPhone is. Okay, true or false?
Okay.
The Tasadai were initially presented to the world as a Stone Age tribe.
True.
Yes.
Yes. That's about the extent of what I remember.
That's sort of a giveaway,
of this
right?
One. Yeah.
Which government official played a significant role in introducing the Tasadai to the world? A. Ferdinand Marcos.
A.
B. Manuel Elizalde.
Oh no.
C. Gloria Macapagal Arroyo.
Oh my god.
D. Rodrigo Duterte.
My god, is it my own province mate? GMA? No. It's B.
Yes. Manuel Elizalde.
Yeah.
And it's actually really colorful.
Okay.
His whole thing in this. True or false?
It happened during Marcos's regime,
yes,
right?
Yes.
The quote-unquote discovery and publication of it.
Okay, yes. Okay, true or false? The authenticity of the Tasadai's isolation and way of life remains unanimously accepted by anthropologists and historians as true.
I suppose it's true, but certain facts of who they are, what they are not true.
Yeah. Well, yes. Yeah. So it's a false.
It's false.
Yes. So let's see. How many did you get? You got South Cotabato. You had language. You had Stone Age. You did not get Manuel Elizalde. You got 4 out of 5.
I didn't get Manuel Elizalde.
You said Gloria Macapagal. Oh,
no,
yeah.
No, I said...
Oh, you got 5 out of 5. This is a Gods Must Be Crazy first. A perfect score in a quiz. I should have made it harder.
No, I didn't get the last one because I said true.
Oh, no, it's false.
With caveats.
Yeah.
And you said false.
The false part of it was experts disagree wildly.
Okay.
Yeah, so it's not the facts, but it's the agreement of experts.
Okay, got it.
It's kind of tricky, right?
Yeah,
it's like
it
a true or false statement. Okay.
Can I just, sorry, this is an aside that has nothing to do with the Tasadai.
Why not?
There's a, I subscribe to this, like, you remember the old College Humor? College Humor YouTube channel. They have their own, like, subscription service called Dropout.
And yeah.
I watch this D&D show, there are Dimensions 20. Anyway,
okay.
You're gonna, if you're a nerd, you should try
which
it out.
Which we are.
You are gonna so love this game show that they have. It's called Actually.
What is
and
it?
And it's basically like, you know how nerds love to correct people
about
actually, that's not true. This is what really happened.
Uh-huh.
So the whole point of the game is the host lists a certain set of statements about specific
Lord
expertise
of the Rings
that they have.
Yeah.
And you have to find out which is not true in this statement.
Oh,
yeah,
I love
it's totally your show.
That's totally me.
Yeah.
That's me and Brian. Me for Star Trek and Brian pausing Ahsoka every like 2 seconds.
Yeah.
Actually.
It'd be like, for example, someone would say, the manananggal detaches its...
legs.
It's arms from its body when it hunts at night. And then you have to say, actually the manananggal detaches from its hip.
Waist so today.
Down. And if you don't say actually, it doesn't count.
It's like a Jeopardy if you don't
Hey, do you guys want us to record a quiz in that style? Let us know.
And you can interrupt.
Okay,
and say,
anyway,
Okay. So as an aside of your aside, so I was walking home today from the mall and I was walking down the sidewalk, and Singapore is very clean. Usually the sidewalk is like totally clear. I saw something, at first it looked like debris. It looked like the bottom part of a drum, like it's like squished up, like a bucket, like a big bucket, like a water collection drum, right?
Okay.
And then the closer I get, I saw shoes. And then I saw pants. And I said, is it like just the bottom of a person? And it looked just like the bottom of a person. But like toppled over.
Okay. Just like a mannequin. Legs. Like a mannequin.
And so I thought it was a mannequin. Yeah. Like sometimes here in construction areas, they will have...
Oh my God, you saw a manananggal.
I thought it was like a toppled over manananggal. And so like I said, okay, when I get closer, I'm going to take a picture. Because they do that. I mean, to be fair.
Did you take a pic?
They do. They dress up like a mannequin and they put it like in at the traffic junctions para ano, para people will stop. Because I think people stop better when they think there's a person. Yeah. Anyways, so I almost did, but the closer I got, it was a dude. It was an actual like worker who was taking a nap under the shade of a tree, but like on the sidewalk, not under the tree, but like in the shade of the tree.
Oh, and then he covered his top half.
Yeah. Like with like a tarp like thing. So I thought it was...
Are you sure? Did you see his head?
I got closer and he was like, you know, imagine. I actually slowed down to check if he was breathing because I was like sort of stressed out.
You were like, is this a daytime manananggal? What's going on?
Oh my gosh. But anyway, so that was my...
Funny.
It would have been so good, right? I should have taken a video like coming up
you
to
should
it.
Have.
Oh
anyway.
But anyways, okay. So now let's delve into the story of the Tasadai, of like the discovery. Super tangent of the tangent. So there's a guy.
Okay.
His name's Manuel Elizalde Jr.
Yes.
And he's, of course, affiliated with the famous Elizaldes, like Lisa Makuha's husband. They're very rich, old Spanish-Filipino family.
From where?
That's a good question. I think Manila.
Okay.
So he was the head of a Philippine organization called Panamin. Remember when we were talking about Pag-asa and like all these weird abbreviations?
I've never heard of Panamin.
Panamin is the Philippine government agency created in 1968 to protect the interests of cultural minorities. So he was the son of a wealthy father from Spanish lineage and an American mother. And he was, of course, a known crony of Marcos.
Mm-hmm.
In 1971, he was in South Cotabato. And while he was there, vacationing, I guess, a local barefoot blit hunter, blit is another tribe in South Cotabato,
okay,
told him of a sporadic contact over the years with a handful of primitive forest dwellers. He said, they are like completely isolated. They don't know a lot of things. They have a completely different language. They're like cave dwellers. They don't have tools. They don't farm. They don't know what the sea is, you know? They don't have words for war. Yeah. So he went and then he got to know these people.
This is his account.
This is his account of his discovery. So they went into... So after he discovered, again, I'll say this with quotes, the tribe, he released the news to the media. And then they went into the forest. Clearing the forest, some of the thickest forest, they said, the thickest forest in the world, which I doubt is the thickest forest in the world.
I mean,
to go to these cave dwellers.
They need like headline. I know.
We cleared the thickest forest in the world. And they were guarded by Panamin guards. Panamin is the government organization. And it was like Elizalde's own like private army.
I'm sure.
And so they answered to Elizalde alone and only allowed a select group of visitors to come. Like, again, National
Geographic. What year was this again?
1971.
Okay.
Elizalde said, to quote, "They have no words for weapons, hostility, or war. They don't even realize that there was a country. They didn't realize that there was a sea. They don't even know what rice was." Because they had no agriculture.
What?
Yeah, okay. That's fishy, right?
Mm.
Sounds fishy. So, Elizalde brought the Tasadai to the attention of Panamin, right? And then Panamin, of course, as a government agency, funded all the efforts to find and visit and study Tasadai. There weren't a lot of them. There were like 30-ish people.
Yeah.
Less than 100 for sure.
Yeah.
So, they funded the visit to study the Tasadai with a small group, including Elizalde's bodyguard, helicopter pilot, a doctor, a 19-year-old Yale student named Edith Terry, and local tribesmen for interpreting attempts. I like that they say interpreting attempts because they really did have a different language.
Okay.
And it was different from the neighboring tribes. So they really attempted to be as close as possible. Elizalde met the Tasadai at a prearranged clearing at the edge of the forest. In March 72, another meeting occurred between the Tasadai, Elizalde, and members of the press and media, including Associated Press and the National Geographic Society.
Wait, so what did they show reporters during the first visit?
First, it was just him. Okay. And then it was like his cohorts.
Ah, okay. So there was no declaration to the media yet.
No. Well, it was like released, but they didn't bring the media.
And then the media junket with everyone came after.
Happened like a year later.
So March. International reporters, yes. National Geographic,
Associated Press, photographers.
Okay.
And this time, they went to the Tasadai secluded cave home site because it said that they lived in caves. Yeah. They didn't have homes. This meeting was popularly reported by Kenneth McLeish in the August 1972 issue, which you read. Wow, that was an old copy that you read.
I don't know. Yeah.
We'll put up a picture of the cover because it's very...
iconic.
Iconic and like very Mowgli, wasn't it? Like,
yeah. Very Jungle Mowgli. Booky.
Yes. It was featured on its cover, a photograph by photojournalist John Lenoir of a Tasadai boy climbing vines. A boy who later on, we find out his name is named Lobo.
Okay.
Which is Spanish like for wolf.
Wolf?
Yeah, yeah.
Wow, this is very Jungle Book.
Right? So these people, here's a quote from the New York Times.
Okay.
These people, who probably number fewer than 100, were discovered by modern men only last summer. They are food gatherers and hunters with no knowledge of agriculture and no way of working metal. There is no word in their language for the sea or for another people, wrote the New York Times.
Huh.
Since these first meetings and reports, the group was subject to a great deal of further publicity, including National Geographic documentary, The Last Tribes of Mindanao, shown in December 1972. Its visitors included Charles Lindbergh, who toured the world on an airplane. Did he tour the world? No, he crossed the Pacific. Anyways, Charles Lindbergh flew an impressive amount of flight times. Also, his child was kidnapped. And that crime was called the crime of the century when the Lindbergh baby was kidnapped.
Damn.
So he's famous. Later on that year, 72 pa rin, one scientist named Carol Maloney told news outlets about his skepticism about the Tasadai. So doubt started creeping in.
Was this like a journalist, not an anthropologist?
A scientist told news outlets, particularly their diets. According to Maloney, so one of the things that they found, their diets were anomalous because if they really were isolated, if they really have been away from the world for 1,000 years, whatever, then why do they have things like sweet potatoes? And sweet potatoes is not indigenous to that part of the Philippines. And it's only
Because it was brought by the Spanish.
Exactly. And it's only grown through agriculture and farming. It's not a naturally occurring root crop.
I learned that. How did I learn that? Because like we didn't have a word for patatas.
Yeah. Only Spanish words.
Potato and sweet potato. Supposedly, we only had taro, I think.
Yeah, yeah.
Or cassava or something.
Yeah, which are related but totally different.
Yeah, and it was brought from Mexico or something
Okay.
So they were like, how did they get access to these things, right?
I mean, if they were discovered last year, why do they have sweet
potatoes?
How
deep was their settlement in the forest? Like, just how far away was it from a nearby village?
Less than
village?
20 miles.
Huh.
Less than 20 miles. Yeah, but it was in the thick of the forest.
You would
right?
think that they would find their way.
Yes, you would think.
Okay.
You would think they would find your way. But the international media focused its sights on the huge discovery, and Elizalde thought it was wise to start limiting the visitations to the tribe's territory. In 1976, a few years later, Marcos started prohibiting access to the Tasadai lands. And the Panamin guards were stationed around the site and barred people from interacting with the Tasadai.
That's so shady.
And it was seen as an attempt to avoid further scrutiny by the scientists and media. So they said, at the behest of Panamin and Lindbergh, he declared 19,000 acres, or 77 square kilometers of land surrounding the Tasadai's ancestral caves.
As protected.
The Tasadai Manobo Blit Preserve. By this time...
Blit?
Blit. B-L-I-T. Blit. Blitz. Is there a different pronunciation to
Blitz? I don't know. It's just, I've never heard that before.
Me neither. By this time, 11 anthropologists have studied the Tassadai in the field, but none for more than 6 weeks.
Was Eflanda Hojano one of the anthropologists?
No, because he was studying in the 40s, right? So by the 70s, he'd be too old, no?
Maybe.
Yeah. Who knows? Marcos closed the preserve to all visitors. The reason was the martial law imposed on the country. Outsiders were unwelcome as that put Marcos under more scrutiny.
Okay.
Eventually.
Martial law was declared in 1972, September.
Yes.
Right? Yeah.
And it was lifted in 1979 or 1981? Yeah. In 1983, after the assassination of Benigno Aquino Jr., Zalde fled the Philippines. This was before the revolution. The revolution was 1986. But 1983 was a turning point for the revolution. Elizalde fled the Philippines. And it has been rumored that he fled and eventually squandered the millions of dollars from the foundation that was set up.
Surprise.
Surprise. Surprise. And it was also rumored that Elizalde used the photos and other information he got from the Tassadai and Blit tribes for money-making businesses in various countries. It's reported that the amassed money he got was amounted to US $100 million.
So he was raising funds to learn and protect the...
It's supposed to come to them.
Damn.
Anyways, so...
He raised $100 million.
He raised $100 million, which he denied. He returned to the Philippines. Eventually, when? In 1987... And stayed until his death.
Just after Marcos got overthrown.
Yes, yes. And stayed until his death in 1997 of leukemia. From 1987 to 1990, Elizalde claimed that he has spent more than $1 million of the Tassadai nonprofit funds. During this time...
Oh, he admitted it.
He admitted it, but only $1
million. Okay.
He also funded the Tassadai Community Care Foundation, or the TCCF. So he started a new foundation and funded that. Money laundering. Okay. Eventually, of course, Marcos was deposed in 1986. And Swiss anthropologist and journalist Oswald Eaton, accompanied by a local journalist from South Cotabato, Joey Lozano, went back. And also Datu Galang Tikaw, a Datu from the Tiboli people, he didn't speak Tassadai, but he came to try.
Okay.
To try to translate. They made an...
Oh, by that time, they hadn't been able to translate their language yet.
Still, yeah. Because it was so different.
Okay.
So they made an unauthorized visit
okay.
to the Tassadai caves, where they spent about two hours with six Tassadai individuals.
Okay.
2 hours with six guys. Upon returning from the forest, Iten and Lozano reported that the caves were deserted. Like, no one lived there.
Before we get to the next part, I think, are you going to describe the fact that when they were found, they didn't wear clothes and all of those things? Before you reveal the what's not true.
Yeah, when they, well...
Because we didn't cover that part.
Essentially, they were like cavemen. So when they were found, their bodies were covered with leaves.
Uh-huh.
Women were topless. There were also a very small number of women. It was mostly men. They didn't have tools. They didn't cook. They didn't use fire, and they lived in caves. But strangely enough,
they didn't cook, so they would eat meat raw?
No, they wouldn't really eat a lot of meat. They would eat mostly fruits. Huh?
So they're basically foragers.
They're basically foragers, yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Because fire, that's not Stone Age anymore. So so they didn't have tools, they didn't cut things, they didn't have weapons.
Huh.
They didn't have a word. They didn't have a word for fire.
If they weren't able to translate the language, how would they know?
I mean, context, right? It's like, what is this? Like, I'm showing you a thing you've never seen before.
Did they record how they reacted when they saw fire?
Of course not. It's 1971.
Okay.
So, you know, so it's this is
so
all
what was the population when they were discovered?
It was about 30 to 100. So it depends on the accounts.
Okay.
Right, of like who came. So, upon returning from the forest, Iten and Lozano reported the caves were deserted and further claimed that the Tassadai were simply members of just the other local tribes who put on a show of living a Stone Age lifestyle under pressure from Elizalde. So they said, Iten and Lozano said, like, it was all a hoax. They're just guys from the other neighboring tribe.
Okay.
Pretending not to understand us, pretending to have their own language. That's what they said.
Okay.
Okay. Hold judgment. Many local tribesmen admitted to pretending to be Tasadai in order to gain funds, reputation, and other items.
Were they able to verify that through photos?
Yes.
Okay.
So there were photos of them, like they had leaves, but they had like brief.
No, I mean, were there photos of like the actual community people?
Yeah.
The actual not outsiders, locals.
From before and after?
Yeah. Damn.
Yeah, their photos. It came from the mouths of the tribesmen themselves. He forced us to live in the caves, recounted one of the men who were interviewed after the EDSA revolution. It was also discovered that one of the Stone Age tribesmen of the Tasadai had relatives living in the nearby town. Swiss journalist Eaton did some digging and he was shocked about what he found out. We don't live in caves. We only live near them until we met Elizalde. He forced us to live in the caves so we'd become better cavemen. The Tasadai man told
How him. Long were they made to live in the caves?
Just so for the show, right?
So this so just when the journalists were there.
Yes.
And then they could leave after.
Yeah, they don't really live there. According to Itan sources, the Tasadai lived in the mountainside. They were farmers until Elizalde came into the picture. Before he came, we lived in huts on the other side of the mountains and we farmed. We took off our clothes because Elizalde told us to do so and promised if we looked poor, then we would get assistance.
Jeez!
Said one of the Tasadais. He gave us money to pose as Tasadai and promised us security from counterinsurgency and tribal fighting. Because there was counterinsurgency at the time.
Did they say how much they were paid?
There's estimations later.
Okay.
Well, I don't know how much they were actually paid. There's just estimations of how much Elizalde got.
Okay.
Okay. 1988.
Because I'm sure he pocketed most of it. Like,
For sure. Jesus Christ. In 1988, some members of the tribe flew to Manila to file a case against the journalists who labeled Elizalde's discovery as fake, and they eventually won the case. With the court declaring them legitimate Stone Age tribe. They flew to Manila to testify that they were legit. 88. So this interview was 86.
Who facilitated this?
I don't know.
Lawsuit.
We don't know.
Against.
Well, you'll see something later on.
Okay.
And then there's...
I can't wait to find out like the whole like the reason why. Behind all of this and whatever. But okay. Yeah. Don't tell me now.
Okay. On the other hand. So, okay. Right? So this was journalist, a Swiss journalist in Lozano. On the other hand. Many anthropologists today still believe that the Tasadai as a Stone Age tribe was a hoax, but they concede that the people were an indigenous tribe and that they were an authentic indigenous tribe. Anthropologist Thomas Headland believes the truth is a mixture of both. That there was a hoaxy part of it, but there was a true part of it also.
But how could there be when they're part of different tribes?
Well... The Tasadai,
I'm so confused now.
Yes, the Tasadai was a hoax when viewed as a group of paid actors that paraded around forest wearing leaves. But they were authentic if they were viewed as a forest dwelling group of people caught in the midst of media, Headland concluded in his 2009 story called The Tasadai Controversy, Assessing the Evidence.
Okay.
In the mid-1990s, a linguist...
Are you going to get into how the Tasadai are their own people?
Yes.
Okay, I'm not convinced yet.
Yes. So okay. it's in the language.
Okay.
So the American linguist Lawrence A. Reed wrote that he spent 10 months with the Tasadai and surrounding linguistic groups from 1993 to 1996.
I'm sorry to keep interrupting you. If the Tasadai were not in the cave areas, where did they live?
In the mountainside.
Okay.
By themselves.
Okay.
But they have neighboring groups.
Okay.
But tribes can exist... with other, you know, like with neighbors and still be their unique tribe.
It
was found in the language. So okay. In 1997 to 1996, they concluded that they probably were isolated, as they claim, but they were indeed unfamiliar with advanced agriculture, that their language was a different dialect from spoken by the closest neighboring group. And there was no hoax perpetrated by the original group that reported their existence. So the original group, they said like, oh, there's this group of people, they're more isolated, they have a different language.
Who's the original group?
The original guy who reported them said like, oh, there are these people, we sometimes see them.
Yeah.
They live this far away, they don't have as much, they're not as sophisticated as us, and they have a different language all their own. And then it was sort of like amped up for the hype, right?
It reminds me of the Sulodnon who are isolated in their mountain.
Yes, exactly.
Like little mountain sulod or room.
Yes.
Okay.
In his paper, Linguistic Archaeology, Tracking Down the Tasadai Language, Reed states that although originally he thought that a Tasadai person named Belayem was fabricating words, like making up a language, after a detailed analysis of the linguistic evidence, he found that around 300 of this person's forms were actually used in Manobo languages of the Kulamin Valley, a place where that person had never visited. So there was it was a related syntax.
Okay.
But a different language.
Oh, so they share certain word roots.
Exactly. Syntax roots.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Reed concluded that the Tasadai's isolation may have lasted only a few generations.
All right.
That they were part of a bigger group originally.
Yeah, who splintered.
And he splintered maybe no more than 150 years.
Ooh.
Yeah. He also mentions that a similar group was later found confirmed to be living as hunter-gatherers without contact with other tribes. They found an actual hunter-gatherer group later on.
But these were not the Tasadai.
Not Tasadai, yeah. Okay. But he proved that the concept could exist.
Okay.
But not these guys. The Tasadai were likely a separate group living as gatherers deep in the jungle who were rarely in contact or trade with neighboring people. But they were probably not a Stone Age culture.
Okay.
Right? In terms of a legacy, there's a French philosopher, Jean Baudrillard. And he evokes the Tasadai controversy in his 1981 book called Simulacra and Simulation to illustrate the phenomenon of simulation at play.
Mm-hmm.
Where he argues that the Philippine governments and scientists' return of the Tasadai to the forest was aimed at constructing the simulation model for all conceivable Indians before ethnology to preserve the reality principle of the discipline.
Can you explain that essentially, in layman's terms?
Essentially, what he said was that, okay, you discovered a new people.
Uh-huh.
It's like the prime directive in Star Trek. Do you watch Star Trek?
No.
So in Star Trek,
the
prime directive is if a civilization is pre-warp, meaning they cannot yet travel at the speed of light.
Okay.
Like us, we're a pre-warp civilization.
Yes.
And if the Federation comes upon a civilization, they leave it alone.
Yeah.
Because they feel that it should progress naturally
of its own accord. Okay.
So essentially,
it's like, when do you interfere on something exactly. And when do you let it naturally evolve or something like
exactly,
that?
Exactly. So he said that the Tasadai were returned so that the Philippines could observe what maybe other tribes were like.
Returned?
Yeah, because the Tasadai, there were Tasadai who left. They were returned and preserved and kept inside the
country. By Elizalde.
By the Marcos government, okay. Yeah. Anyways, okay.
In 1988,
new president.
Yes,
Cory. Yeah. On the advice of the Congressional Investigative Committee, Cory Aquino had pronounced the Tasadai as an authentic minority group. She legitimized them.
Okay.
But many scholars remain skeptical, and the hope of any conclusive evidence on either side of the controversy was beginning to fade.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where we end.
Really?
They're legit.
So nothing else happened after?
Well, a lot of interviews have happened. There's a couple of new theories that happened. So now this is where I dive into sort of like...
What do Filipino anthropologists say? So you quoted a lot of Swedish anthropologists.
Yeah, so there's some local journalists also that have their accounts. And they think it is a mix of both. They think that they were a backwards group.
Maybe not backwards.
I mean Stone Age, hunter-gatherers.
Okay.
So yeah, a lot of them...
Was it true that they've never used fire or...
I don't think so.
Clearly not if they've Clearly been not. Living no, no, communities. No. Was it also true that they're not agricultural?
They were agricultural. They had sweet potatoes.
Yeah, exactly.
But then there's another theory.
Okay.
Of like, what if...
All right.
What if, from the span of time when they were discovered to the time that more journalists came, they wanted to live, hey, like, nice pants. Can I have a pair of pants? Hey, can I have shoes?
But didn't we just prove that they actually did wear clothes because they've been living?
They did when more journalists saw them, right? So remember, there's a span of time, 1971 when they were first discovered, and then the journalists didn't come visit until 1972.
But you just said that they were told to remove their clothes.
Yes, but that could be just people saying it. You know, it's
good. So you believe? So
I can. I think I don't believe. I think it could be either way. It could be like, for example, there was a small group. This is all the things that could have been. There was a small group. They were really shy. They didn't want to talk. So they recruited other people who were their neighbors, who really were more, you know, whatever, exposed, and they took off their clothes and stuff. They interviewed like 2 to 3 people, and so they could just say, he told us to remove our clothes and live in the caves. Now, things that are probably true is they didn't live in the caves because they couldn't find evidence of it being lived in.
Yeah.
Like, if people live in caves, you see things like...
Chairs, you'll see like tables,
you know, or like...
Storage.
Cleanliness, bathrooms, latrines, like a system, yeah, right? A system of living. That I don't think is true.
Okay.
I do think there was a hunter-gatherer group. I don't think everyone who was attributed to be Tasidai were hunter-gatherers.
Uh-huh.
And I think it is that thing of, you know, there's this book I really like to listen to over and over again. It's called Born to Run.
Mm-hmm.
It's about the Tarahumara tribe in Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
And they're like pre-colonial. They escaped to the Barrancas, to the copper mines, copper mountains. And it's very treacherous to go. But they are like the strongest ultramarathon runners in the world.
Yeah.
And there's a race there every year, an ultramarathon race every year. But this guy, he lived with them. He's called Caballo Blanco.
Mm-hmm.
And this
white horse?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. White guy. So there was, but this, there's this, the tribesmen, there were people who really stayed with their roots. They didn't use money. They only ran in their ceremonial robes. And then a little bit south, there are these people who wore running shoes, who wore like pants,
mm-hmm,
and like sunscreen and things like that. And then, and the nutrition bars and ate carbs and things like that, and ate hamburgers. But they were all the same tribe.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's something like that with the Tasidai. There were probably people who really were like very much cloistered.
Yeah.
And separated for whatever reason.
Yeah.
They feel like it, geography. And then there were people who were interested in the outside world. They came out, then they came back in because, oh, you know, we are still Tasidai,
yeah,
even if I wear underwear, but I'll get money.
So the Tasidai were part of, so what do the theories say? They were part of a bigger ethnic group? Or they splintered from a bigger group
150 years ago. A Manobo
tribe.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Probably
okay.
A similar route to a Manobo tribe.
Okay, because the Manobo tribe has like they're been huge. There for
a long,
centuries.
Long time. Yeah.
Okay, and
so they probably splintered off. Mm-hmm. They got isolated. So they, over 3 generations or so, they developed their own language. They developed, yeah, their own practices. They eschewed other things.
For and if one it's just reason. 150 years, then that's really not like there's lots of modern. Like, there's a lot of technology that they would have had anyway.
I don't know.
Right? Because the Spanish were here 300 years.
Yeah, but this is South Cotabato.
So?
It's very far. So? But they were part of the Saba Sulu Kingdom.
Yeah.
Which brings us to the why.
Wait,
why?
Wait, before this.
But even if they could have been influenced, maybe they didn't want it.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I mean, there's...
No, I'm not saying that, yeah, they didn't exist. I think it's very, very possible.
Yeah.
Right? And it's also very possible that some people would sensationalize that and,
yeah,
try to kind of like create this myth or this fantasy of,
yeah,
like a highly, highly
isolated
person or culture. But we have seen through a lot of the, I mean, look, the fact that a lot of the epics and old traditions of certain tribes have survived because they were isolated,
yeah,
right? I keep thinking, the entire time you're mentioning it, I kept thinking of the Panay Bukidnon tribe,
yeah,
and the practice of the Binokot, and that's how it survived because,
yeah,
they were in a way isolated, right?
Yeah.
And that doesn't mean that they did not have access to all those technologies. They just could exist within their own ecosystem,
yes,
without having to,
yes,
go so far and,
yeah,
trade ideas, trade words, trade,
yeah,
goods,
yeah,
as much. And
women.
This is probably what happened,
yeah,
with them as well.
Yeah.
It might be, maybe they were quote-unquote backwards just because maybe they did not have access to the technology.
Maybe they are also...
stuff like that.
I think it's also they wanted to be left alone. There was like,
yeah,
a self-sufficiency.
It might have sprung from a need for survival.
Yeah. I think the need for survival, that's one, but also there was still tribal conflicts happening at the time, and insurgencies also.
That's
like
true.
Terrorist insurgencies or like communist insurgencies or whatever insurgencies were happening in the 70s.
Are you going to cover any, have you learned anything new about them since?
Yes.
Okay. Or that's later.
Not anything new, but like just new theories of them.
So have there been no further studies on the Tasadai since?
It was in that context of was it just accelerated social change?
Do we know any of their system of beliefs?
Oral tradition? That's the thing. They were Stone Age. They didn't have language that was written, quote unquote.
Did they have oral tradition?
They didn't seem to have practices like gods and goddesses. They didn't seem to have...
Really?
Yeah, they were like nature worshippers. Yeah, I looked at like Tasadai beliefs and practices.
They're animists?
Maybe, because they were hunter-gatherers and nature...
I guess we don't know.
We don't know.
What you're saying.
The anthropologists weren't able to learn that because
much.
The language was... It seemed like the language was so hard to crack.
So until now, we still don't know their language fully?
Well, I think they're starting to figure it out a little bit more because when they found that the root was similar to a Manoba form, and more of them are exposed to the world, they get to be interviewed now, right? So there's more and more in the language. But like, if you look for Tasadai beliefs, Tasadai culture, Tasadai traditions, Tasadai superstitions, Tasadai festivities, and I was like, oh yeah, because the festivities are usually around... Harvest. And so if the press release was they didn't have farming, then they maybe didn't have it. But if you look at who they really are, who are farmers and things like that, then maybe there would be a differentiated belief. But that wasn't written down.
Got it.
It was really approached from a very, I don't want to say... Like, it was anthropological, but anthropological in the way that we look at, like, Denisovians and things like that. And just the structure of the language. There wasn't even... If you look at their photos, you know, I mean, and again, the stage photos.
I guess in the absence of any kind of artifacts that they could get, they only had the language.
So only the language.
It's purely a linguistical study, is what you're saying.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And that's interesting. Like, I'm sure Stone Age people had tradition. Like, they had art, they had cave art and things like that. But these guys didn't even have cave art.
So, sorry, I'm still confused. Do you believe in the Stone Age part of it?
I believe that not all of them were Stone Age. I believe there could have been a portion of them who were Stone Age, who were hunter-gatherers.
So, absolutely no tools, no fire whatsoever?
Yeah, I believe it. There are still tribes like that in many parts of the world.
Okay.
Yeah. I'm not saying that it's like all 30 of them and all 100 of them. I'm thinking like maybe they're like five guys. And Elizalde was like, oh, okay, the rest of you guys pretend to be like them.
Okay.
That's what I think.
All right.
But I don't think there was an absolutely no Stone Age people. I think there were some still like hunter-gatherer people.
Okay. It's really hard, no? Because like, what's the defining characteristic of a Stone Age culture versus not?
It's pre-tools.
And if what you're saying is they've mixed with the other tribes anyway and whatnot, like...
They're choosing.
If you have a house, you have to have had tools.
Yeah. I'm not saying all of them lived in the cave. I'm saying like most of them probably had a house.
Yeah.
That's what they said, right? They were farmers. They lived in the side of the mountain. But like a portion of them were... Because there were these anthropologists that said there were details that we found that could not have been made up. They said just details that could not have been made up. Anthropologically. I don't know exactly.
But we will not share the details
with
you. We will
not share it. Look at the article and look at the guys, right? And like, so there was a deep dive that happened from that was written by AJ Bolando from the Philippine Daily Inquirer. Which he gave the why.
All right.
Do you want to move on or do you
want
to
say? Yeah.
So in terms of the why.
Why Elizalde did this.
Yes. Why this whole thing? Why this whole complex?
Yeah, it's so weird.
It's such a weird hoax,
just
right?
To get money?
Well.
Okay.
Do you remember the Kingdom of Saba? Sabah.
Yes.
Is a territory of Malaysia.
Yes.
And it was part of the Salu Empire.
Okay. And where's this going?
And
okay.
We own, the Salu Empire is part of the Philippines. The Salu Sultan swore an oath, bent the knee to the Philippines.
Okay.
And when, as part of a gift...
Because the capital of the kingdom was in...
Yeah. And the I don't know if the capital, but like the Salu king, Sultan, said like, okay, we're part of the Philippines now.
Okay.
Right. The company that owned Sabah,
uh-huh.
It was leased by the West Indies Company or West... It was one of those British...
East Indies.
Or
Dutch
company.
Indies.
Not Dutch Indies. I think it was a British one.
Okay.
Owned Sabah.
Okay, because I know Dutch in
Indonesia. And their lease ran out.
Okay.
And so they gave it back to the Sultanate of Sulu.
Okay.
Because the Sultanate of Sulu, hundreds of years ago,
uh-huh.
leased it to them for like, let's say, 100 years.
Interesting.
When the lease was up, he's like,
so
okay,
random.
Back to you. Territorially, Sabah is part of Borneo.
Yes.
And it was actually given by the Sultan of Brunei to the Kingdom of Sulu
mm-hmm.
as payment for rebellions and things like uh-huh. that. But by this time, when the lease was up,
okay.
Sabah was not part of Brunei anymore. Sabah was part of Malaysia.
Okay.
And so when the lease was up, the Philippines was like, no, it's ours. Because it was owned by the Kingdom of Sulu, and the Sultan of Sulu is bent the knee to us.
Okay.
Malaysia says, it's clearly here. It's clearly here in our territory.
Yeah.
And so that was what the dispute was about. We had to prove that we had ancient roots, and the Tasadai were very close to the sea. We're actually very close to the sea. And they wanted to prove that ancient civilizations, ancient Filipinos have existed, and they wanted to eventually create a link to Sabah, fabricate a link.
Oh my God.
For Sabah, so that to strengthen our claim. Like, our people have been here forever, and see, our culture has survived, blah, 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 blah. But Sabah was not like some, you know, hick town or whatever.
Yeah.
So this was the beginnings. Even just the beginnings of a grand conspiracy that they wanted.
By the way, guys, just so you know, my jaw has been like on the floor for like the past 3 minutes. Yeah. What the heck?
To claim to have a claim in Sabah. Unfortunately, in 1978, the citizens of Malaysia voted. The citizens of Sabah voted
and to stay in Malaysia.
We want to stay in Malaysia. It's kind of like Singapore, right?
I mean, look at the martial law.
I mean, right? So yeah. So like.
Are
in the pursuit, yeah.
Wait, so obviously then Elizalde was told to do this
yeah.
by
so
the
administration. So the article says, starts off with, in the pursuit to claim Sabah, the Marcos government needed to establish the long existence of Filipinos.
This
as
is
a
so
nation,
strange.
As a nation. He had to establish that the Philippines is a nation, we've been around, and so we have sovereignty.
So basically... We have the oldest civilization,
so
and
we
therefore,
have the biggest right to
we have
it.
The claim to this
yes,
land indigenous.
Yes, yes.
Wow.
Because of the age of our tribes.
Wow.
So yes, that's the whole why. Because like this is like, oh
so
yes,
random.
I get it. Yeah, yeah. But surely it should have had a motivation.
And money. Yeah, sure. You wanted to make money, but why to go through all that like hullabaloo and inventing stuff that could
because of oil
could eventually so easily be
and they were just it's just so but again one of the things that was the Marcos regime was very good at was myth making and they still are they're really good at believing tugging the hearts of the people. I think Elizalde was just sucky at it, so he failed. In doing so, he was really good, by the way, with the people. He was well loved by the people.
Clearly.
So here's an account. You know what they called him?
What?
They called him Momo Dakel Diwata Tasadayor, or the great bringer of good fortune to the Tasadai.
Oh, because he gave them money
and so forth
and stuff.
I love this article so much. It says, Elizalde, known for being a playboy and a drunkard, was in command after Marcos appointed him as presidential assistant on national minorities. That's what Panami means. The heroes of the Tasadai left in 1983, right? reportedly bringing along with him the millions he raised for the group and funds of the Panaman Research Center. For 17, and this is his testimony.
Elizalde himself.
For 17 years, I've been accused of having cordoned off the Tasaday Reservation in order to take advantage of it for business reasons. 17 years have passed and I still have not gotten nothing from this land whatsoever. He said in a 1983 documentary by Nova.
This was before he admitted to using $1 million.
Yeah. Exactly. So, which isn't. I mean, so I have this whole thing. Like, who was this guy?
Elizalde?
Yeah. So where did he go after? They say he went to Costa Rica.
Did he discover another tribe in Costa Rica?
I don't know.
He still alive?
No, he died in 1987.
Ah, okay.
Of a leukemia, right? Okay, so here's what I mentioned about, like, it's like accelerated textbook case of change. So two anthropologists visited after the revolution.
Mm-hmm.
Oh no, not the revolution, like 1972. But he wrote this later on, John Nance. He wrote a textbook case of change. We're seeing a textbook case of social change compressed in time, said one of the anthropologists, Jesus Peralta, who is the curator of anthropologists of the National Museum of the Philippines.
Mm-hmm.
The other anthropologist who visited, Carlos Fernandez, said, before we met them, they were purely forest gatherers. Then they learned to use a blade to set traps, and now they are learning to hunt. Before long, they will try their hand at planting. This is one of the most exciting subjects for an anthropological investigator. So, Mr. Nance, who was the author of The Gentle Tasaday, who traveled the last month to Mindanao with the two anthropologists, said that Tasaday's preference for t-shirts and other articles of clothing was only natural. If leaves were better, we'd all be wearing leaves.
True.
Right? He said. They also wanted... The scientist said to the question of a hoax has always been present and remained the possibility. But there are some details such as stone tools and the language used by the Tasaday, which would be extremely difficult to fabricate. So they had tools, stone tools. Unless other anthropologists produces conflicting data, then the literature stands. Many of the changes were brought to be the result of two outside influences, a tribal hunter named Defal and the marrying of women from a nearby tribe called Blit. When the Tasaday were first discovered, they were mostly male cousins, uh-huh, all related. And the Tasaday's main request of the scientists who discovered them was for brides.
Oh.
So Peralta said that in the years since, 15 Blit women and 2 men have been married into the tribe. Defal, who was the other tribal hunter, and the Blit spouses brought them clothing, beads, knives, rice, cigars. And they said they taught them to trap and use bows and arrows to supplement their traditional diet of yams and hearts of palms, rattan and fish, and frogs and tadpoles.
Mm-hmm.
That's what they ate.
Mm-hmm.
They were already in transition when we met them. And scientists worked hard to reconstruct what their life had been before that. And the people took to the reconstruction as the current reality.
Okay.
Yeah. When they returned again, the Tasaday were wearing leaves over what appeared to be bits of clothing. We told them that it was unnecessary, and the next day they came out in all assorted kinds of ragged clothing. The Blit women were more or less fully dressed in a blouse and skirt, beads and bangles. The children were in leaves, and so it was a motley crew. The scientists left gifts of clothing to them, and now a pair of Fernandez's sandals is walking around there along with my hat, according to Peralta.
Was this after
it's
the
a year after
hoax was quote unquote?
No, this was before the hoax was uncovered.
Okay.
Yeah. Hoax. This is so these two anthropologists and John Nance went the year after. But he wrote this much later on.
The like year after it was announced.
Yes, so 72.
Okay.
Before it was restricted. And then this was written like years later. And like sort of in hindsight. So it's like, what did we see happening? Was it a hoax or was it just a case of accelerated social change? Because mm-hmm. people kept coming and of course people are going to bring things, right?
True.
They were happy to see them. The scientists and a number of Tasaday recognized each other years later, but the reunion seems to have involved little emotions, the scientists said. They were happy to see us, of course, Fernandez said. But there were some hard questions. What happened to you? Why haven't you visited in so long?
Oof.
What do you want this time?
Oh.
Yes, years later. The Tasaday were particularly concerned about the disappearance of Elizalde. who they called Momo Dakel or the Great Uncle.
Yeah, because like I'm sure they were promised a lot of things. They're getting all these attention, so they thought that, oh my god, our life's gonna be so much better. We're getting so much attention and help.
So like if you
and
talk
then
to,
suddenly it stops.
Exactly. So if you talk to some of them, like some of them were like, oh, he was the great uncle, he was the great provider, blah blah blah, and then the other people were like, yeah, he made us get naked and blah blah blah. So like there's like still different points of different receptions that people have, right? And I think it could be because some of these people were not genuinely hunter-gatherers, but I think some people just take things differently, right? Mm-hmm. Some people are like super grateful for stuff and some people are like super kebs about stuff. So I think it's just a really, it's not black and white. It's not just as straightforward as like, was it a hoax or was it not, right? So the scientists are still perplexed by Elizalde's role, and they said they thought it was possible that he did manage the actual presentation of the tribe. He may have urged them to present themselves a certain way, like living permanently in the cave. But they said he did not have the scientific background to have fabricated the data they had gathered on the tribe.
Mm.
So they said like, yeah, I could have staged it, but there are these details that, again, I don't know exactly which details, that Elizalde, who was known to be sort of a playboy and drunkard, could not have, you know, anthropologically produced it.
What does this being a playboy and drunkard have
I
to
don't
do
know,
with...
but that's what the article said.
You can be smart and a playboy. You not can saying be it's
like,
true.
Like, hello, have you not met Tony Stark?
Those are not mutually
exclusive things. Right?
I love all the journalists. Like, he's a playboy. He can't.
Known drunkard and playboy.
He can't possibly have...
known drunkard and playboy. One last trivia. One of the princesses of Salu, so what the government did to sort of ensure that we had the loyalty of the royal families of Salu was to commission them. So one of the princesses of Salu, her name is Princess Mumtaz. It's my tita. She was an Air Force major.
Okay.
And she lived in the base with us.
Ah, so they got her to
be a commissioned officer. And like her kids went to the same school as me.
That's so random.
It's super random, but like it's just like it's such a weird facade.
Mm.
But also, so in my mind, right? If I were to write a movie, poor man's copyright.
Such a convoluted,
right? If I were to write a story, it's kind of like, you know what it reminds me of in some way? It's like Anastasia the cartoon, where they went out to perpetrate a fraud.
That's true.
They were going to trick. They got a lady who could be convincingly Anastasia, but it turns out she was Anastasia. And it feels a little bit like that Elzade set out to just make a fraud to improve our claims on Sabah, but there were just things that he shouldn't have known, or they shouldn't have.
There's certain things that
it's not clean. It's not a clean hoax.
Built on certain, they're probably like small things, and he built and created this own like version of his story of what it is.
Yeah.
Is there a similar type of hoax that we know anywhere else?
No. The only thing that I would think is similar but not a hoax is the, you know, when they took the Filipinos, the tribal Filipinos, and they put them in the human zoo.
Oh, God. Yeah. Yeah,
which was a recent, was it a New York Times article? In Tagalog, they put it there.
I'm trying to think.
So, in as much as we usually cover pre-colonial gods and goddesses, superstitions, and maybe even modern, what do you call it? Urban legends, like the Robinson's Galleria snake twin, which I find highly enjoyable. I really wanted to discuss this because it's like, it was a myth. It was myth-making. It was deliberate myth-making with a deliberate end. But it's not that clear, was it? You know? How true was it? How untrue was it?
And it's unfortunate because in the process of doing that, you lose the actual truth of who these people were.
Yeah.
What actually happened, because you interfered. You got in the way.
And I was thinking about, like, when you were asking, like, what are their traditions? What are their blah, blah, blah? Maybe they did have them, but they were forced
I'm sure
to,
they did.
They were forced to...
If they're a community that survived for that long, you can't... Yeah. Like, a civilization has to have... Yeah.
There's Tiboli myths. There's Manobo myths. There's Lake Cebu myths. Lake Cebu has the weaving.
Or is it a case of... And again, this is conjecture, so please don't take it as...
Wild speculation.
Yeah, this wild speculation. It could be that if they were so isolated, you said they were running out of brides, they could not keep up. Like, their population dwindling?
Maybe.
And remember, the keeper of tradition, the keeper of stories are the...
Women.
The eldest people in the community, because they're the ones who hand it down. And maybe they were losing that and they had no way to preserve it. They had no... They didn't... Maybe they were thinking so much of survival that it wasn't as much of a priority to preserve, like, our beliefs and traditions because, look, we just gotta survive.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. We don't
and
even
And there
have...
was no one to tell them, we have this belief of the sun and the moon and whatnot.
They were just trying to eat tadpoles.
I mean, other human beings have eaten...
Frogs, I get
it. Stranger things.
Tadpoles. There's nothing in there. It's just
we eat caviar.
This is true. It's just a bigger tadpole.
It's just an egg.
Yeah. I was thinking, another part of me was thinking, like, could it be possible? You know how in America, in the Appalachian Mountains, it's an ancient mountain range. Some people will leave their communities and choose to live in the mountains. Usually it's men. And they will sort of
like monks?
No, like survivalists. Aesthetics? Like survivalists.
Like preppers.
Like preppers, yeah. Mm. And then they'll come down to get a mountain wife.
Oof.
I know. And so there's... But they have, again, they have access to civilization.
Yeah,
quote unquote.
They just choose not to.
They just choose not to. This could also be another part of that, right?
I remember a hoax now.
Okay, go.
Do you remember the quote-unquote missing link that Darwin found? There was some anthropologist supposedly found this.
Oh, yeah, yeah,
this Piltdown Man, what if that thing?
Yeah.
And they were like, oh, it's a mix of an ape and a man. And this is the missing link.
Yeah.
And it turns out it was a hoax.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was just an amalgam of a skeleton.
Yeah. Yeah.
Fake. Like, I know, the Shroud of Turin. The Shroud of Turin. Like the Fiji mermaid.
That's true. The Fiji mermaid.
Yeah. The Fiji mermaid is not as big as I thought it would be.
Or you know, who took that picture? When they took pictures.
The fairies?
Yeah. Of quote-unquote fairies. And it was just like paper dolls, basically.
Yeah. Because it wasn't. They didn't tinker with the film or tinker with the photograph.
Yeah, but how could they prove it?
Practical effects.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So that was our, I think that's our first hoax story.
I think so.
Mystery and controversy.
It's still... I feel so conflicted.
Me too.
And I think that's why I kept probing you on how do you know? How do you know? Because it's
I don't know.
Stacking up. Are you not an anthropologist?
Just kidding. Not an anthropologist. I haven't met a Tasa diaper, so...
It's not stacking up neatly in my head. And obviously, I've not gone through as much of the material as
I watched the UP lecture on it.
Yeah.
A 30-minute UP lecture.
Yeah, and I'm just like...
I think that's the thing, too, with, anthropology and, civilizations that are just... It only seems simple when there are only a handful of sources.
And it's that ultimate, scientific struggle of, how much can you understand something without affecting what it is,
exactly,
right?
Exactly.
I'm sure there's a word for it. I don't know what it is
it's
right
It's called
now.
The prime directive. And,
okay.
No, I think
circle back.
Principle. There's Heisenberg principle of, if you're observing something and you change it.
But that's
on an atomic level. On an atomic level, if you introduce an aspect of measurement or observation, it changes the phenomenon.
Yeah.
But it also, I think, works in an anthropological
and
spacefaring sense.
How can you understand them better without changing who they are? And you're right in this case. And, you know, the problem is there was a very deliberate outside interference, aside from just the study, of changing or presenting certain aspects in a different way. It just makes me so sad.
Yeah.
Because I guess number one, just from the sheer, I don't know, is it good? It's that ultimate question of, do you have to modernize every single culture?
No.
And is this really good for them or not? Right? Yeah. Because the whole argument against, the whole argument that colonizers have had for many years is these are barbaric cultures.
We're helping them improve their lives.
We're helping them. They've been, like, they have weird, like, cannibalism or, like, headhunting practices.
Yeah.
And they paint this picture of a very, very violent culture, which may or may not be true.
Yeah.
But most cultures stem from those kind of violent roots as well. Natural progression of a civilization.
Yeah, but then who's to say?
Yeah.
Who's to say that, that the values of the colonizers are the correct values?
Exactly.
Correctness is not the absolute value. It's like, I know, it's like there's an article on National Geographic just earlier this year, and it said a new tribe has been discovered in the Amazon that has never been in interaction with the outside world.
I saw this.
Now what? No, that was the article.
It's true.
Now what? Yeah.
It reminds me of Ender's Game, the sequel, Speaker for the Dead.
Speaker for the Dead,
yeah.
Or the Xenocide.
Yeah.
It
brings me back to, because this was a feeling I had when we dove into the Binukot last year. It's just so conflicted. And if you guys haven't listened to that episode yet, or you've forgotten about it because it's last year, I think it's worth a re-listen. It's called The Princess in Her Tower and The Princess in the Betel Nut. But basically, it's the idea of that cloistered maiden.
Mm-hmm.
And it's quote-unquote special in a way because it's such a unique kind of cultural practices, number one. Number two, it's proof of, like, the richness of a specific cultural heritage that this tribe in Panay Bukidnon has. And number three, most importantly for a lot of us who are studying and trying to understand this, is it was a means of really preserving the culture and tradition for so long. Because these kept maidens were cloistered, and all they did, not all they did, but one of the key things that they were tasked to do was to study their oral traditions and their traditional dances and rituals and conduct it.
Yeah.
But the question that you always have is, there is value in keeping all of these, but, like, is there a natural, I don't know if it's momentum or entropy, like, you have to eventually evolve because maybe this doesn't work anymore in this day and age. Because when they interviewed these maidens, I mean, they weren't very happy with it because they felt like they had no choice, they had no agency. They wanted to do other things.
They wanted to go to school.
Yeah, the daughter of one of the oldest surviving Binukot maidens said, I really wanted to go to school, so I didn't want to go through it anymore. And so there's this kind of, like, what's the word for panghihinayang? Regret?
Like, what a waste.
Yeah, something like that. Kind of like a regret of, like, oh, we don't get to keep this tradition anymore. But at the same time,
should we have kept it?
I think it's more, is tradition set in stone? And it's not.
It's not. It changes.
Right?
Yeah.
That could still be part of your identity. This was part of our history, but it's not necessarily all that we are anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And it kind of brings up that feeling. And I took so long to explain that I'm so conflicted because there's no conclusion. Like, you just have to wrestle with it as you kind of keep learning more and more about these kind of instances, you know?
Yeah.
There is value in learning what we had in the past, but we also have to accept that change happens.
Yeah.
And part of who we are now is this whole journey that we're also having as a people of rediscovering all these things again. Things that maybe we forgot, we never thought we wanted to know or needed to know.
Yeah.
But it's helping us appreciate who we are, and it can help us build you know, a richer kind of version of our culture.
I have, like, two conflicting ideas in my head, right? So, like, in terms of, like, preserving pre-colonial culture or any point in time culture, right? Post-colonial. How we're building tradition today, this podcast, right? We, even the selection of things that we keep
That's true.
To remember is motivated by something else, something true. Separate, and something maybe might be driven by benign interest.
Yeah.
But also could be driven by malevolent intent of, you know, claiming another
or just
country.
Selfish intent.
Selfish intent, yeah. Glory. It's sexy. I understand it better than this other piece of thing. So I'm just going to forget that other thing, right? There's that one piece of it, right? One could say that you're making room to create new traditions and new interests because, you know, civilization should follow that. And this is our whole conversation of like history set in stone or like tradition set in stone. And it should always change because I also have in my head the Buddhist concept of impermanence.
Yeah. Right?
And I think I told you this, but there's this riverbend in Cambodia where you hike up like 2 kilometers to get up to, it's not hard, but it's like a rock riverbed, right? So it's stone. It's not a sandy riverbed. And they say, the monks say that the water that goes through that riverbed came all the way from the Ganges. Mm-hmm. So it's blessed and holy and Hindu blessed, whatever. It goes through the riverbed. On the riverbed, they have carved a few hundred years ago scenes from the Ramayana.
Mm-hmm.
So there's like war scene, there's a loving scene, there's like a god scene, you know, there's like all these happenings from the Ramayana. 200 years prior, French preservationists said, we have to stop the water because
it's
going to wear it down. It's going to wear it down and eventually it's going to be like just a smooth river bed face. And so they did, you know, the monks were like, whatever, right? They closed it off. But when the riverbed was dry, it was very ugly. It didn't show the glory and the beauty of the scenes. And so the monk said, can you put the river back? Because we want to appreciate the beauty of the carvings and the meditation that it offers and the blessing of the scenes by the water.
That's true.
And then the preservationist said, well, if you let the water run there, you're going to lose it in like another 200 years. Yeah. And they're like, that's why it's beautiful. That's why it's important, because it doesn't last, right?
That's true.
And so in our pursuit of remembering and recapturing accounts from the past, it's important, yes, because it's important for us to remember our roots. It's important to us to know our contexts apart from the context that were given to us.
Yeah.
But at the same time, there's also that aspect of, are there any Tasadais left? Are there any, there's like the last Binokot is still alive, but she's going to be the last one, right? Wang Od, who is the Mambo Batok, she's passing down her tradition to her niece. And then what if wala siyang mapasahan? What if it doesn't go on? And there's a panghihinayang in that, but also there's this other concept of like, well, then let's appreciate it for what it is now.
Was that Japanese wabi-sabi? It's the same thing.
Wabi-sabi is the broken one, right?
That's kintsugi.
Oh, kintsugi, yeah.
Wabi-sabi is also like about the beauty of impermanence.
Yeah, yeah.
And you kind of just have to accept it.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's going to happen.
We got deeply philosophical at the end of this course. This is like an investigation, and we're ending up with Buddhism and wabi sabi. Anyway, so yeah, that's it. That's what I had.
That was so good.
It was interesting, right?
I'm still so confused.
It's unsatisfying. Right?
I'm gonna definitely be doing my own research tonight.
I'll send you that lecture from these two UP professors. But
who were they?
Like, I don't know them by name. They weren't in the writings. They're very young. They're on YouTube, and they're like
I'm glad that people are still looking into it.
I know. I love it. But it's they cite the same sources, and it's also unresolved, right? Mm-hmm. But it does dive a little bit deeper in terms of the evidence that was found, the linguistics and stuff like that. So
interesting.
It is. And it's hard to interpret it without the context of political agenda and the weight of that. And so I tried mm-hmm. hard to not be super ultra angry. But yeah, so I wonder if there are still I'm sure there are Tasadais who reached modern world. If any of you are out there listening,
I wonder if anyone's studying or
they still are
like capturing their, like, have we finally
translated the language?
Have we translated the language? Do we know any interesting practices or beliefs? Anyways, that was such a fun episode.
Thank you. I was going into it. I had one point of view and I came out the other end with a different point of view. So if there's like a piece of like, that's my favorite of like having my expectations change.
That's true.
So it's good. I liked it. I enjoyed it very much.
We hope you guys enjoyed that episode. So tell us what you think. Do you think that it is completely a hoax? Or do you think that there is some truth to it? Are the Tassadai really a Stone Age civilization discovered later in time? And if you are aware of any similar interesting hoaxes, weird controversies or theories about
modern myths,
and things like that, let us know. We'd love to hear about it. We'd love to hear from you, and we'd love to cover it.
If you're keen to
enough
share.
Enough, like, evidence that we can look into. So, Anima, where can they find us?
You can find us at thegodsmustbecrazy.pod on Instagram and on Facebook. And we are on YouTube also a little bit. We are also on Patreon. And you can listen to us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and all the platforms that you listen to. If you are keen to do so, maybe give us a nice 5-star rating. Thank you to all of those who already have. Our hearts are so full.
You guys are so sweet.
You're so nice.
And as always, the best way to support the podcast is to talk about it. Share it with your friends. Share it with your family. Share it with your Lolo and Lola.
Lola and Lola.
Share it with your non-Filipino friends. If you want to freak them out about our different monsters and gods and stuff like that. You know, the best way to support is always to just share the word. And hopefully more people can discover the podcast and hear about all the interesting stuff that we're learning about Philippine mythology and folklore.
If you want to leave us a message or a voice note, you can reach out to us on our Instagram. We're pretty good with that. Sometimes when the messages are so nice, sometimes it takes us a while to answer because we're so overwhelmed with feeling.
We kind of have to like
the more heartfelt, the longer it takes us because we're like
Jordan of the Asong Project sent
Jordan.
Sent us a really, really, really nice message. It took us a year.
I know. Sorry, Jordan. We love you.
But that just means that we're like,
really thinking about it and feeling it, feeling our feelings. Also on anchor.fm, you can leave voice notes also. So do leave it there because it's always fun and we'll try to also include your messages.
Or on Instagram. You can
on Instagram also, you can do voice notes.
But yeah, until next time, guys.
Bye.